Welcome to Through the Penard, your conversational podcast talking to amazing midwives and other birthing professionals who have done their PhDs or doctorates or are doing something really interesting. So settle back and enjoy the conversation. Thank you very much for joining me. As per usual, can you introduce yourself, please?
Sure. My name is Megan Arbour. I am a nurse midwife and a certified nursing educator, and I have my PhD in nursing from The Ohio State University. I am faculty at Frontier Nursing University, which is a distance-based institution in the United States. It is housed in Kentucky, but we have students all over the United States and in some military installations abroad.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, where our students come. We only teach graduate nursing students, and midwifery in the United States is a master's degree or higher. So the program I teach in currently is the DNP, the Doctor of Nursing Practice program, and my specialty is evidence-based practice. So yay. I'm delighted to be here today. Yeah.
Excellent. We're going to have possibly lots of chats. Maybe not necessarily on the one episode. So Jane, as you know, Jane was one of your is co-workers. We ended up doing a double episode for her because especially in the American system, it is so different to what a lot of us are used to in the healthcare system, but also the education system as well, in particular for midwives. So I think that was kind of quite interesting to get a basis on. Let's go right back to the beginning. How did you get into midwifery?
Well, let's go back even further than that. My bachelor's degree is in music education, and I was a music teacher. I taught K-5 elementary general music. Mm-hmm. And when I was doing my music education degree, I knew it wasn't really the right fit. I didn't want to do it, but I did want to be able to graduate, get a job, and not move back home with my parents. So I proceeded. Mm-hmm, I proceeded with music education. I did get accepted into a prestigious midwifery education program for right out of my undergrad, but they wanted way too much money, and it was just not a financially sound choice. So I went and taught for a year at a school in rural South Carolina in the South. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And every morning I prayed that an alligator would be on my doorstep so I wouldn't have to go in.
Oh, that
never happened. Yeah, it was that awesome. It was so fabulous. In the evenings, I would take prerequisites, anatomy and physiology and such, so that I could apply to a variety of other programs. And then I applied to The Ohio State University, and they said, we would like to pay for you to come to school. And I said, I would be delighted to come. Yeah. We not only want to pay for you to go to school, but we want to give you a stipend. And I said, sold. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that was really good. So how did I know midwifery was the calling for me? I actually lived in Scotland for 4 years when I was growing up. My dad was a dentist with the Department of Defense with the U.S. Navy. And I'm one of four. My mom had a birth in Scotland with the midwives, and it was her best birth. And so I remember her talking about that. When I was growing up and would have career day at school, I would always come home and say, I'm going to catch babies. This is what I'm going to do. And excellent. My parents were like, okay, you know, that when the family doctor had come on or, you know, come to talk to us or different things. So I was passionate about it from a very early age. In high school, I had an absolutely horrendous biology teacher who made me doubt myself and believe that women can't do science.
Oh.
I went on to win like the high school science award, and I was a salutatorian of the school, and you know, like I, but he changed my career trajectory from sciences to music because I was also good at music. So I did music, and then like I listened to my heart and I went to midwifery. So my midwifery education program was a graduate entry program because I already had a bachelor's degree in another field. Yeah. It was a 3-year program. A year and a half would take me to the nursing degree. And then a year and a half after that, the master's. So it was a busy, busy program. And for somebody with very little, I mean, I'd done a lot of volunteer work in hospitals and I'd spent as much time in the birthing space as I could, but I didn't get all of those degrees and credentials and things until my master's degree.
So what kind of still resonates in your, I suppose, mind and heart about your training course, your education in becoming a midwife, looking back on that time?
Well, yeah, so I had an in-person midwifery education program. So I teach at a distance-based program now. I work from home and I am not clinical right now. And teaching is my jam. And I think I knew when I was doing the music ed that like I liked the teaching part of it, but I didn't like the subject area, right? So, but the educational psychology and methodologies and things like that, they transfer very nicely. But my midwifery education program was a small cohort. I think we had like 8 students, and I'm still very close friends with a couple of those midwives. Yep. I think being together, learning new things face to face was essential for me. And I've come to realize that if I were confronted with a distance learning opportunity versus an in-person opportunity, my brain would work better for the in-person opportunity. Yep. But I certainly understand that our current students, they have so many competing obligations and responsibilities. Like work, kids, family, all the things, they wouldn't be able to do it. So the other thing is that I completed all of my formal education by the time I was 29. Mm-hmm. I graduated in December and had my first baby in March. Like, so I was pregnant at graduation. Yep. So like I got the PhD done. I got the midwifery degree done. Like I got it all done because I knew like it would be impossible to come back.
Yeah.
Like not impossible, but really hard to come back after. So, but I think I look back on my midwifery training and I realize how much of the education really depends on the quality of your preceptor.
Yeah.
And the relationship between the student and the preceptor, and whether the preceptor really understands you as a person, or are they teaching you in a way that reflects the way that they were taught? Mm-hmm. And because I had excellent preceptors, and then I had others that I struggled with.
Yeah. So looking at your undergraduate, well, it's not, because it's postgraduate, because it's in master's. In Australia, we have, regardless of what level it is, whether it's undergraduate, whether it's a grad cert, postgrad, the leading body for us, which is the Australian Nursing and Midwifery Accreditation Council, we have to do a certain number of births, complex vaginal births, postnatal, antenatal visits, things like that. We have a prescribed amount that everyone, so regardless of whether you're doing it in 1 year or 3 years, everyone has to meet the same. Do you have the similar thing going through for the midwifery that you have to attend certain number of births and types?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we have the Accreditation Commission for Midwifery Education, ACME, A-C-M-E. And
oh, that's a really bad. That well,
I know, right?
If you're like a cartoon favorite, it's a really good one.
I know. So ACME is our accrediting body. And midwifery education in the United States is competency-based. Mm-hmm. So the idea is that you need to do enough pap smears until you're deemed competent. You need to do enough vaginal births until you're deemed competent. However, they have suggested minimum numbers that you couldn't possibly be competent in a vaginal birth until you've had this many vaginal births.
Yeah.
You can't possibly be competent, you know, with a breast exam until you've done this many breast exams. But the idea is that you shoot for more than the minimum, right? Yeah. You get as many experiences as you can. But I had one clinical practice that I worked with that through no fault of the midwife's own, just politics in her office. I would drive up 2 hours to go spend a clinic day with her, and she would have 3 patients on her schedule for the whole day. Mm. And that was like really challenging for me to get any of my quote unquote numbers, because I'm driving 2 hours up to spend a whole day and I get 3 patients.
And
I think that contributed to her stress too, because working with me, because she wanted me to have the best experience, but she didn't have the patients herself, let alone to teach me with. So that was challenging. but I live in Ohio and I went to school in Ohio, and the midwifery space in Ohio, we have Case Western University in Cleveland has a midwifery education program, the Ohio State University in Columbus, and then the University of Cincinnati. Those are three midwifery programs in addition to Frontier, Nursing University, and several other distance programs. So there's a lot of midwifery education programs competing for preceptors in Ohio. And that's part of the challenge of being a program director, for sure, is finding good preceptors for your students, because it really does significantly impact the quality of their experience.
Mm. Do they have the same preceptor for the whole of their placement clinical time, or it's just dependent on the venue that they go to, they get matched up to one?
So ACME, our accrediting body, doesn't care. Each school is kind of different. So I teach now at Frontier Nursing University. Previously, I taught at the University of Cincinnati. And then, of course, I went to Ohio State. So they all have different ideas of what the expectations are. It's good to have more than one preceptor, because then you get to learn. You get to learn what you want to do as well as what you don't want to do. And you get more than one role model and more than one network experience. And then you also get the opportunity to, you know, perhaps see some out of hospital birth, which we have very, 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 very little of here comparatively. So.
Oh, so where did you end up working then after you finished your initial midwifery qualification? Or did you go straight on to the PhD?
So I did my initial midwifery, and I worked at a federally qualified health center in Columbus, Ohio. So it was a series of six clinics in the scariest locations when I think back on it now. The buildings were not sound. You look across the street and see drug deals going down, like gang violence in the area constantly. When I think about now, I left there at 5:30 p.m. and it would be dark outside in the winter. And are you kidding me? I actually worked there.
Did the clinic have any trouble from the gang members or from criminals, or was there a kind of a default respect?
For the most part, we were a safe haven kind of place that we didn't have trouble or violence there. And, you know, people came to us even if they were fearful of immigration control people, because we were that safety net clinic. I did lose, I had a headlamp that I would use because we didn't have a gooseneck lamp. So I had a headlamp, and I had set it down in after I had taken it off because I was sweating and it was a hot day, no AC in the space. And after I had done an exam and I was doing something else, I had taken it off and put it on the counter. And then I left the room for the woman to get dressed. And when I came back, it was gone. And they're like, no, it's not. And I'm like, I know I left it here, but really they probably needed it more than I did. And they probably sold it or used it, you know, but that was the environment where you couldn't really trust that what you would leave there would still be there. Mm-hmm. And what I really struggled with was once I had my feet under me as a new midwife, I wanted to be able to take on students, but the rooms that we were seeing patients in were barely big enough for me to walk around the bed as the table, then to have a student in there as well. So that was challenging. That's where I worked. And I worked there full time while I was working on my PhD. And I knew that I wanted to get my PhD, and Ohio State said, we have this money and we'll keep paying you. And I was like, I would be foolish not to do this right now. I would be foolish not to do this right now. Yeah. So, I met my would-be husband during the PhD program. So he was with me during my whole PhD. And then we got married and were pregnant. And then I graduated. And then we had the baby and all the things. And in my clinic job, I had asked them for 6 months off. And they said, absolutely no way. Absolutely no way. And I said, okay, well, that's fine. They're like, you can have 3 months off. And I said, well, fine. And at that point, I had been teaching adjunct online for the University of Cincinnati as a professor. And I upped how much I was teaching, and I was able to cover our mortgage and our gas bill and several of our. And so then when 6 months passed, the clinic called and said, are you coming back tomorrow? And I was like, are you kidding me? Like, no, no. Had you been willing to work with me from the outset, that might have been a thing. But now I'm making enough money and I'm home with my child, and no, I'm not coming back. So at that point, I transitioned completely to teaching, and I got full-time jobs, and, you know, it proceeded from there. So my clinical, my full-time clinical career was very short. But I think it was what it needed to be for me and for our family.
But you also would have seen quite a lot in that time when you're thinking about that type of clinic. A lot of, from my understanding, non-insured people, lower socioeconomic, so people Absolutely. Who were struggling in day-to-day survival, but also in health equity, in the poorer end of health equity. So the experience that you would have got and seen
Right.
is still completely valuable.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
So then you kind of float. So you've already mentioned that Ohio were extremely generous, and I wish all places were like that, because that would make life a lot easier.
Yeah.
Getting into your PhD, had you thought about doing your PhD while you're doing your master's, or was it because they said, look, we can support you to keep on going? What got you into your
PhD? Well, interestingly, during my second year of my master's degree, my job, my assistantship was with the graduate recruitment office and graduate admissions. And so I worked with giving tours to prospective students and talking to people and going to fairs. And, you know, I recruited for the graduate programs. And so my bosses in that office were always looking for PhD students. And so they're like, come on, Megan, you know, you want to. And I'm like, but I need to practice. And interestingly, part of my clinical experience was in Maine, which is where I grew up, which is like, it was like a 16-hour drive from where I was going to school. But I went and I lived at home with my parents, and I did clinicals, precepted with a midwife who was the mother of one of my schoolmates growing up.
Oh, cool.
And yeah, so she offered me a job upon graduation, but she was only able to offer me a 0.6 FTE.
Yep.
And I was faced with, do I take this 0.6 FTE and get all kinds of good experience, but really it's not a full-time job. And, you know, like, how do I live on my own with not a full-time job? And I'm a single person and all of these things. Or do I take this fully funded PhD with a stipend and the FQHC? So it was kind of hard, but I think I made a good decision and proceeded with the PhD, and, you know, it served me well. It served me well throughout the years here. Yeah.
There are so many sliding door opportunities where
Absolutely.
One decision, and like, I'm sure there's somewhere there's multiple parallel universes where whichever decision we didn't take, there's a version of that living off somewhere. Did you end up doing a thesis component or a research component for your master's?
No, my master's, I had a comprehensive exam for my master's. So there was no thesis for the master's. It was an exam. But certainly I did a dissertation for the PhD.
So let's talk about that. What, since they offered you a position fully funded and stipend, which is absolutely the golden kind of egg to get, did you have an idea of what you wanted to study, or was it because of the people who were there who could supervise that helped direct you into that area?
Yeah, that's a great question. So a lot of people who choose to do their PhD after they've been out practicing for a while, they are passionate about a particular area of research, and they know that without a doubt, that's what they want to do. And so they look at PhD programs where somebody is doing research in that area that may be able to fund them, et cetera. So I came at it a different way because I was still relatively green. Certainly when I applied, I was still relatively new to this environment, but I was passionate about maternal morbidity and mortality, and I was passionate about numbers and crunching numbers and using the evidence and looking at reasons for why. So I had a math minor in my undergrad, so I knew that I wanted to work like with a large data set to be able to do this. I didn't want to be like some of my friends who were in the basement of the College of Nursing doing their PhDs, and they were like in year 6, 7, 8, and they're like, I got another participant this week. And I'm like, oh man, I don't want to do that. Yeah. Like, no way. No way did I want to do that. So I hooked up with Dr. Betsy Corwin, who is a physiologist. She's a family nurse practitioner and she does physiology. I think she's at Emory University right now. Mm-hmm. And she was my advisor. And then I had my midwifery professor was on my committee, and then Dr. Pamela Salisbury was also on my committee. Marcia Atkins was my midwifery professor who was on my committee. So I had this team, and Pam Salisbury was great at the large data sets. So I had the physiology, the large data sets, and then the midwifery. And so then we started working on it and looking around. And in one of my classes, we used the NHANES, National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey data out of the CDC, and looked at douching patterns in women. And I was like, wow, like we can answer a question about douching patterns using this secondary analysis of the data. And who knew that there was a data set that asks women about douching and how much and all of that. But I thought it was so brilliant, like, because I wouldn't want to recruit women to ask them about douching, but there was this like data set that already existed that talked about, you know, their socioeconomic status, all these other measures that maybe would contribute to their desire to douche or not to douche. Yep. And it turned into a manuscript. So that was really kind of like, ooh, I could totally do this. And so then I learned about the theory of allostatic load and how different stressors in our lives and in our bodies can contribute to poor health and how our bodies have worse health. So I created a measure looking at blood sugar. I think I had A1Cs and blood pressure and BMI, and, you know, several different measures, race, ethnicity, socioeconomic status. And I looked at those measures using a logistic regression to predict whether these people would have been at risk for a preterm birth or not.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, it was pretty interesting. So it's no surprise then that, people who were in worse health were more likely to have poor birth outcomes. I didn't have birth outcomes in the data, but I did have, you know, different racial and ethnic groups had worse health versus so it was kind of a theoretical tie. And then the idea would have been to go do some other like real boots on the ground kind of work to make, but I didn't follow through with that line of inquiry specifically. Certainly within my midwifery education and teaching people midwifery, that was certainly in the background, but I didn't publish then significantly on that topic. And you said, you know, you mentioned talking with Jane Houston. So a lot of the work that we work together quite a bit, and a lot of the work that we've been doing recently relates to trauma-informed pedagogy and nursing, nurse midwifery teaching strategies and educational. And that was really, you asked me, why did I get the PhD? Like that was really one of the reasons is because I knew that I wanted to teach. And the DNP was not yet a thing when I was doing my degree, and I knew that the PhD was a universally understood doctorate degree that would enable me to seek that kind of career.
Which brings me to a question, because the DNP is something that a lot of people don't know what it is. So what can you explain the difference between a PhD and a DNP, please?
Sure. So the PhD, you have a degree in research and you're trained in how to conduct research and generate new knowledge. It is a degree that is known across disciplines. My brother has his PhD in psychology, for example. But there are also clinical doctorate degrees. In psychology, mm-hmm. it's like the PsyD, right? In pharmacy, you can be a pharmacy PhD or you can have your PharmD. So in nursing, we have the PhD in nursing or we have the DNP, the Doctor of Nursing Practice. And so the DNP utilizes the research that's already out there to improve the care of people, whereas the PhD is trained to generate the research, right. generate the knowledge.
And they're both level 10, so they're both deemed as terminal qualifications. You can't get any higher. So they're kind of equal right. at that rate.
I think it's kind of, some people get both, and I think, oh, man. But, yeah, some people get both.
It's like, really, do you want to, well, I suppose it's give some credit for some work that they're doing or an excuse to focus on something. If I want to get a second one. And Jane mentioned that there's also now the DMP. So Doctor of Midwifery Practice is starting to raise its head.
Yes. So that is a new degree. It is not well understood or described yet. There's just a few cohorts of graduates. Jefferson University, I think. Jefferson University in Philadelphia is offering the Doctorate of Midwifery. And so it is just midwifery students, and all of the work is focused on midwifery, as opposed to a PhD in nursing, where you have to take a lot of nursing theory and nursing methodology and nursing research, or the DNP, which is nursing. The DM is another version of a doctorate degree that, again, is not well understood. Yes. And I think, at least in the United States, and I don't know how it is in Australia, in the United States, nursing has too many iterations that people don't know who they're working with or what you are. They don't have any idea if you're a certificate nurse, if you're a LPN, RN, associate degree, RN, BSN, if you're an RN with your master's degree, if you are a nurse practitioner or a nurse midwife or a doctorally prepared, like they have no idea. They have no idea. There's too many different versions. And I think a DM just adds to that mix, though the thought of midwifery specific cohort. And I'm not sure if it's a clinical degree or a research degree. That's enticing, but I think there's still a lot of ambiguity there.
I think our system in Australia, at least, is a little bit cleaner that we've got midwifery for us. We've got one level and you're a midwife, but we also then have the level above that, which is an endorsed midwife. And so they're the ones that can prescribe medication. So probably similar to a nurse practitioner, so almost a midwife practitioner. And they're the ones who can also do private practicing and do full care in private practicing and private home births and things like that.
So midwives, CNMs in the United States, depending on which state you're practicing in, can do private practice, and we can all prescribe, but each state has their own regulations on, yeah.
And that's what we're looking at the moment. There's a big national survey going around to all midwives at the moment, looking at scope of practice and what they can and can't do. Because whilst there's certain things we can do straight from graduation, and the scope of practice has been curtailed by venues about what you can and can't do. So a lot of midwives are unable to work to their full scope of practice because of the regulations that the venues and hospitals will have onto them. And it's not with our registration, because our registration is fairly clear in what we can do. Mm-hmm. And we're slowly increasing. And so this is going to be the start of, I think, some amazing changes in Australia in the scope of practice and recognition of midwifery, because we are still fighting, probably the same as many countries, that midwifery is a separate qualification and separate discipline to nursing. And so many people see it as a subspecialty of nursing. And I think Australia and New Zealand were one of the first regions in 2020 to actually get our research code separated from nursing, So our actually research code is no longer underneath. We actually stand alone as a separate discipline, which is means we're going to fight for everything again and rebuild, but it means that the future is actually going to recognise, because as you're saying, so many people don't understand the differences in the level, the terminal mm-hmm. qualifications. And even internationally, there's so many, this advanced practice midwife or advanced practice nurse, a lot of people think if you do a PhD in midwifery, you have to go into academia. They don't understand the clinical role. UK has now got an advanced practice clinical role, which is looking at for midwives with PhDs, but they're obviously kind of ahead in a lot of countries and a lot of areas. But it's finding that, keeping those midwives who want to be kind of clinicians, who want to change practice from the ground floor or from whatever level, but not necessarily in academia. And we need to explain what those roles do and what the qualifications need to do better. So that could be a nice little bit of a joint activity that we could do, kind of like sitting out and working out, explaining what they do so people can kind of understand.
Yeah, it wouldn't be hard at all, right? Yeah, no, like just public information campaign, right?
Yeah.
I think culturally people are like, I need to go to the doctor. So they look for a doctor, right? They say, I need to go to the doctor. And they don't know necessarily what the differences are. And then until very recently in Ohio, you can they license and acknowledge certified nurse midwives, but not certified midwives, which have the same training but aren't nurses. And they don't acknowledge in the legislative code certified professional midwives or other midwives who are practicing in Ohio and calling themselves midwives, and perhaps doing home births or birth center births, but they're not regulated. Yeah. And so people think of midwife and they think of this person down the street who really doesn't have any business doing what they're doing because they don't have the training, the insurance, the backup, the, all the things, the safety nets. And so that's really a challenge.
I think that's one of the things that we've got here is to call yourself, it's in law that to be call yourself a midwife, you have to have a recognized training and be registered with the health board.
It's interesting, and I know people are still trying to get around it, and we have a lot of maternity care deserts in the United States where you have to drive 40 minutes to an hour to 2 hours to find a maternity care provider or a hospital. There's a new practice it's not a new practice. It's probably as old as time itself practice, but it's called free birthing, where you're birthing without anybody there with you at all.
Yeah.
And so the question is that better, or is it better to be free birthing, or is it better to have some marginally qualified person there with you? And I don't know the answer to that question, but that's kind of the situation that exists.
We saw an increase in free birthing around COVID, especially with the restrictions in COVID and who could come in and support people and partners not being able to stay. But yeah, and there's, when you look at the conversations that are happening online and you look at some of the research that comes out about the women's experiences of being in healthcare settings, of obstetric violence, of the birth trauma and of the levels of PTSD, it's easy to understand why women choose that route. If they're not going to be respected in the people that they're supposed to trust, then why would you go back there a second time? But then you've got the extreme free birthers who are going, oh, I'm going to go give birth in a river or a creek, which looks pretty and looks all mystical and magical. But then you just sit there going, that water's cold, that baby's come up, you're cold. And then you just think of all these kind of like physiological things that poor baby's got to kind of go through in that first few minutes because they're kind of taking photos or whatever. It's just like, just get that baby warm. But, yeah, so you've got the same issues. But, okay, we see an awful lot about government, politics, changing of rules. We won't get into Roe versus Wade overturning because that's a whole conversation in itself and the after effects of that. How do you deal with that as a practitioner but also as an educator when you know that you're trying to teach students best practice, evidence-based practice, and then they're hearing all this basic kind of garbage that is anatomically impossible being spoken to people who are making laws? How do you keep saying?
So I have a few things that I juggle on a regular basis. One is that, like, the practice environment you're going to is not an evidence-based practice environment. How can I teach you to be smart and use the evidence to take care of your patients? How can I teach you to impact change in your clinical environment to reflect the best evidence? That's one. The second thing is that I struggle with is that midwives are leaving practice.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's a problem. It's not just a problem in the United States, but midwives are leaving practice after not long of practicing.
Yep.
And so we're busting our humps to really get midwives trained and get them licensed and credentialed and out in practice for them to burn out and fall out of the bucket within 5 years.
Yeah.
And I have a major problem with that empathetically. Like, we're not teaching them for the real world of what their job will be. And so how do we practice midwifery in a way that meets the demands of the people who need midwives, the women and the families? And how do we change the culture of clinical practice so that we don't lose all these baby midwives and all these new midwives from clinical practice? That's a huge issue. But certainly teaching evidence-based practice, one of the big things that the students learn in my class is that everything that's published isn't necessarily true or good. And just, right? Like, that's one of the big things. You think that because it's in a journal and an editor reviewed it and it's been peer reviewed and it's published, that doesn't mean it's any good at all.
Yeah.
And we spend a significant chunk of time looking at the methodology and they're like, just get to the results. Well, the results don't matter if the methodology sucks, right? Yeah. Like, and that's really hard to digest because we all have those stacks of journals that are piled up on our bedside table or in the restroom or wherever. And you might read an article here and there, or you might just read the title, or you might just read the abstract, but we can't practice by just reading the title or the abstract. Yep. We have to really think. And so really turning on that critical eye is really what I try to do. But then they go beyond my class and they have to learn what their preceptors are teaching them. And it may not be the evidence that's best, but as I said, you learn as much what you do want to do as what you don't want to do. And I think that's important to recognize.
And it's not just the professional journals that they need to be able to critique as well. And we've been having some fabulous conversations with students here that are looking to do their honours next year. And we're going to have a fabulous research. The topics that they're wanting to do are just so exciting. But also social media and looking at the influence of social media, because that's where women are getting their information from. And especially when you go, okay, you've got Facebook, then you've got Insta, but then you kind of look at the younger ones are going to TikTok. And it's TikTok. Really cool to see an increasing amount of health professionals who are taking the jump into TikTok by refuting the evidence. And there's a couple that I kind of follow as well. And so they'll end up doing stitches. Somebody will put up with this information and then someone will come across and stitch it in and go, right, here's the real truth about this. And this is where you're going to do it. Here's the evidence through it. And it's like nutrition and exercise. So it's really cool to see this counter kind of community happening that is kind of coming from truth-free to now credibility of information coming back again.
But also in the language that the consumers are communicating in, which is really essential. Yeah, TikTok is, I think it's taking our attention spans down significantly, like the Reels and the TikTok. I think it's really, so when we're teaching, we can't give an hour lecture. We can't give a half an hour lecture. No, like the attention span is no longer there, which is really interesting.
And it forces us to look at who we're teaching to. They all grew up with Google. They grew up with like internet where of, and now it's like it's just secondhand knowledge. And yet they've got so much knowledge that they difficulty in actually working out how to bring it down to what's actually real and what's not, which adds to stress and sanity. So let's kind of go back to your PhD time. You've talked about your supervisors and how that they were relevant to different areas. So doing that three years full time, meeting your soon to be husband, and then kind of getting married and having a baby. How did you balance your sanity during all of that time when we know that PhD is the hardest time for a lot of people?
Right. I didn't. So one of the things that my body does when I'm stressed is I sleepwalk and talk.
Oh, wow.
And it's really fun. So when I was living on my own, I ended up putting one of those, the apartment that I lived in had like an interior hallway, and then you open the door, you close the door, the door's locked because it had like a key card. And so you can't get back in. So I put an alarm, like a door chime door, so that if I opened the door, I would, because more than once I would go to bed in my bedroom and wake up in my living room. There's only two rooms in my apartment.
Okay.
I would go to bed in one room and I'd wake up in another room. No idea how I got there. One time I went to bed in my bedroom and I woke up and I was throwing all of my pajamas out of my pajama drawer. No idea why. I remember vividly in our first home, we rented a home together after we got married, my husband and I. And I remember vividly waking up and snakes were coming out of the ceiling at me. Like terrifying, like falling out of the ceiling, like snakes coming at me. When I finished my PhD, all of that stopped.
Wow. Like,
that was my brain saying, hey, woman, this is too much. Like, this is too much. But I would talk in my sleep. He would say, hey, did you know that you were no. So anyway, my undergrad roommate, I had the same roommate all 4 years, and she would say, hey, I wrote down what you said last night, because it was hilarious, right? So
excellent.
Like school, yeah, great, right? So that's what my brain and body do when I'm stressed, is I sleepwalk and talk. And it's kind of weird. And if I'm sharing a room with somebody, it's obvious to them. But that has stopped since I finished my PhD. So I would say finishing the PhD was harder than a protracted birth with a giant baby and no epidural. Tom took me to a baseball game and I had my comps or something the following week, and I could not relax at the baseball game at all. I was just like, I need to get home and study. Like, it was awful. It was not fun. So I really, really, really worked hard, and I was glad to be able to only be doing that and not having kids at the same time or the distractions of life. You know, I was practicing, but I was doing school stuff, but it was really hard. It was really hard. It was a degree of perseverance more than anything else.
And I think that's one of the things that has come across in almost every interview that I've done or every chat that I've done, is it's PhDs are not about intelligence. It's about determination and perseverance and stubbornness and the people that you have around you. It is that all-encompassing thing that unfortunately people still think that they're not intelligent enough to do, and that's the issue with it. So how did you celebrate when you finished, apart from getting ready to give birth?
Right. So I graduated in December. And we had moved into our new home like in August. And so we had a big Christmas party and had lots of people to the house. And it was like a graduation / Christmas party. It was fun. And then I had a baby a couple months later. So
then
you
went back to, stopped at the clinic then, and then started teaching full time within that. Mm-hmm. So how has your PhD, did you think it changed practice, it changed information, or how did that impact on you from what you learned from doing that area?
I think it gave me a much broader perspective. It gave me more insight into the way that nursing academia works and the games that are played within the institutions of nursing. Because I was working during my degree clinically, but also working with the faculty and taking nursing education courses, I got more of a backdoor look into the workings of a university. Because as a clinician, as a master's student in nursing, you don't necessarily know all the things that are going on with the faculty role. But then when you're talking to the faculty about grants and publishing and this and that and the other, like, and the various roles of faculty, I think doing that degree really helped solidify my knowledge about the role. I did conduct a big job search then before I finished my PhD, because we figured if we were going to move, then, you know, like that would be the time before we bought a house, would be to move and go to a big job. But I knew that, I think, and my husband says it's my neurodivergence, and it probably is, that I knew from very early on that I wanted to work from home.
Yeah.
I really struggle with working in an office or in an environment where I hear people around me all the time. I can't focus at all.
Yeah.
Like, I can't focus at all. So I kind of sought out a work environment that worked for me and the way my brain works. I taught at the University of Cincinnati for 10 years in a distance capacity. And so that was 2 hours away from where I lived. I would drive down once a month for meetings and I'd come back and that was fine. I was program director of the midwifery program for several years in the middle in there. And I had two children and blah, blah, blah. The dean there, she got rid of all of the offices for master's and graduate faculty and put in cubicles because she wanted us to collaborate.
Oh.
But you weren't allowed to talk
to
people because other people can hear you. You weren't allowed to talk to students. You weren't allowed to record a lecture. You had to like go into a secret space to do that.
Yep.
So it was horrible for me when I would go down there. I couldn't get anything done because all I hear is all of the noise around me, and it was supposed to help with collaboration.
It doesn't.
No.
And the research has shown that open offices actually decrease collaboration. They increase frustration, and productivity actually goes down because of those distractions.
Right, exactly. And, you know, I was talking, my husband worked from home a day earlier this week, and because it was snowing up in Cleveland, and he didn't need to go drive into 15 inches of snow, and he just stayed home to work. And that was, you know, it was good. So he, I went out and I unloaded the dishwasher, I reloaded the dishwasher. And it was like a 5 minute break, right? I went out, I unloaded, I reloaded, and I came back and I was like, so that's a brain break for me, which if you're in an office, you might go walk around, chat with people, distract other people, have a drink at the water cooler, whatever. But I'm going and doing something productive all the while my brain is solving whatever problem I just had. But I can also pop the laundry in or out. I can walk on the treadmill while I'm having a meeting with somebody, or I'm listening to a faculty meeting. Like, it's good for me. It's good for me. So I feel very fortunate that I've landed in this place where I was able to get experience first as an adjunct faculty and then as a full-time faculty at Cincinnati, to then be able to go to Frontier, and where I'm respected and valued for what I can contribute. And I'm one of the, you know, a senior faculty person there, that I'm respected for what I can bring to the table and not shamed for what I'm not. So
I think that's something that I've seen in social media as well, and with conversations with different people, is what and who is a midwife. And a lot of the times it's like, you are a midwife if you are still, you have to be clinically current. And it was really interesting at the ICM, so either the ICM in Bali this year or it was the Australian College of Midwives National Conference in September, where Jackie Dunkley Bent kind of came and gave a talk. Now, she's gone from the chief midwife of the England to now the ICM's first chief midwife, which is brilliant to have somebody up that high level. And she was kind of going, but I still do my clinical. And last month I did a clinical and it was really good in COVID, that even though that I was the chief midwife, that I still kind of did some shifts, and I got up against this policy that I couldn't understand. And my colleagues were telling me, well, you're the one who wrote the policy and sent it out to us, so you have to kind of like follow it because you wrote it and you're telling us to follow it. But it was really frustrating. Was here we have a midwife who is at a high governance level, who's at a high leadership level, and yet is kind of saying, oh, but it's still really important that I do my clinical practice, which is great for her, but it shouldn't set the scene that everyone has to do clinical, because it's not possible for everyone, but we still have to respect those midwives who are in education, who are in governance, who are in clinical, who are in leadership, who aren't necessarily still physically in the clinical mode, but are connected in other ways, that are still doing just as much kind of important work for the profession itself.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of ways to midwife and be a midwife and contributing to the body of literature and the pedagogy and all of the policy and all of the things. But there definitely is a eat your young mentality, or even not eat your young, but you're a less than or a canceled midwife if you're not still in full scope. And that is one of the things with social media. It's very easy to cancel to call people out, as opposed to try to understand why they're doing what they're doing and trying to support their needs and accepting people for what they do have to offer, rather than shaming them, as I said, for what role they don't fit in that your brain says they should.
So a last question for you, potentially one that you may not have the answer for. Where do you see midwifery going in America in the future?
Oh, that's kind of scary. So the American College of Nurse Midwives has taken a very turbulent ride of late. If it were a roller coaster, it would be like, and it's just starting to come back up. And the American College of Nurse Midwives, you know, fewer than 40% of the midwives in America are members, yet the ACNM writes the standard setting documents that all our states base our scope of practice on. And they do the lobbying work and this, that, and the other, but there's a lack of trust. And so it's really hard to think about midwifery in the United States when our national organization is struggling so much. So the state affiliates are strong, in many cases stronger than the national organization, but that's going to be divisive because each state affiliate is going to start doing their own thing. And that's not a good thing either. And where we have such a lack of understanding of what midwifery is nationally, that's still an issue. To have our national organization kind of fall out is really a challenge. So I hope within the next 5 years that midwifery can improve the workplace culture and environment. Some of the work that I've done is related to sleep and sleep deprivation in midwifery and midwifery education, which is huge. And I think one of the reasons that many midwives stop practicing full scope midwifery is because their bodies can't take it. Mm-hmm. And we have this machismo society of midwives where if you can't do the overnight, if you can't do all the things, you shouldn't be doing any of it. And I think we need to support an improved culture of midwifery to recognize all the different ways to midwife, and keep those midwives that were graduating in practice instead of having them fall out of the bucket with their student loans still to be paid, but them not practicing. So that would be my dream. I don't know if that's what I think will actually happen, but that would be my dream, is that we can work on sustaining our numbers by improving the culture.
Thank you so much for your time.
Sure. This was fun.
Thank you so much for joining us today. And if you enjoyed this episode, please reach out and let that person know. And if there is somebody that you want to hear about, send me the details.